Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of 91.7 KALW, local innovative public radio for San Francisco.
We're continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
And from Philosopher's Corner, that oasis of thought, they migrate to this oasis of the air, and then to the internet via our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org. You won't quite claim it's an oasis, but it's something cool. And you can now listen to Philosophy Talk anywhere, anytime, at least the best of Philosophy Talk, by downloading our podcast.
Today, Ken, our topic is justice across boundaries or borders. What do you think about that?
Across? Why? What? You know, is there some kind of why do we say justice across boundaries? Is there some kind of problem with justice and boundaries? I mean, what's the deal?
Well, I think the problem's a bit more complicated than that from our point of view. Everybody thinks that there is a sense of justice that extends across borders. We say it's an unjust world. It's unjust that people in some countries have so little and people in other countries have so much. But when philosophers think about justice, they mostly develop their theories within the context of a state. So justice is an attribute of a particular state. So how do we get a hold on the idea of justice outside of that context?
And there's a good reason. I mean, there's some good reason for that anyway. I think I deserve equal protection under the law, free speech, equal economic opportunity. I enjoy those things as a participant in an American political system, right? I mean, I say the government should treat all Americans equally. The government should provide us all with free speech. We shouldn't have economic inequality among Americans. Okay, but take me and some Indian in India. We live in different political systems, different economic systems, right? We have different governments to make claims to or against. So what's this across boundaries stuff? I mean, I'm not quite sure. Does my country owe India something? Do I owe Indians? Do I owe individual Indians something?
Well, Ken, your point of view, typically philosophical, simple-minded, and out of date, may have made sense once when we were a pretty isolationist-type world. But in the first place now, as citizens of the United States, the one remaining superpower, at least for a few years— we're controlling a lot of what happens around the world, and the people that are affected by this have no vote, for one thing. And for another thing, economically, our economic decisions impact the whole world. And in terms of economies, a lot of them are much more local and don't respect boundaries. Why should a kid that's born in Monterey or Matamoros have fewer rights for participating in the Rio Grande economy than a kid that's born in Brownsville?
Well, I mean, to the extent that there's like international regulation of relations, of economic relations or relations between states, I guess that makes sense. But it's still kind of hard to me because, again, laws are made by nations. Economic regulation is done by nations, by and large. And then they have treaties, but that's a little...
Well, it's getting much beyond treaties now. I mean, after all, World War II, American prosecutors prosecuted people from the Third Reich. Now we've got the International Court, and criminals from Bosnia are being tried by international tribunals. There seems to be international law, so we need to think about international justice.
Well, that's true. And our roving philosophical reporter looked into the process of international justice for war crimes in particular. She files this report.
What would you do if your father or son was taken away by armed men and disappeared? Or your mother or daughter was taken to a rape camp? If you can't get justice in your own country, you can look to courts in The Hague.
We often have this idea and hope that they will find closure for what's happened to them.
Eric Stover directs the Human Rights Center at UC Berkeley.
What I've learned in my work, and I would just caution over and over, is that we should actually expunge the word closure from our vocabulary when we talk about victims. One has to understand that all memories in war are local. It's that you suffered under the hands of a torturer, or you watched your children killed in front of your hut. Those things are not easily closed. Justice can help in that process, but we can't say it brings closure or helps people move on.
The post-Cold War world is trying to deliver justice on a global scale.
The international community has decided that there are certain crimes that are beyond the pale, and that those individuals who commit those crimes should be brought before a court and given a fair trial. That has very salutary effects in that you do eliminate the Charles Taylors, the Slobodan Milosevic's. You get those people out of these countries and in the proper places, in jail.
Stover's book, The Witnesses, contains interviews with victims who've testified at The Hague.
People, when they come to testify, they're trying to make sense out of chaos. It's hard to believe that other human beings could commit these crimes, even though they found it difficult, even though they felt the sentencing was too low for the enormity of the crimes. It was a positive experience testifying. Not because they necessarily found closure, but because they felt that they had to go and testify on behalf of those who were lost.
I asked him how the world could deliver justice to situations like Darfur.
If we are going to say that there are certain crimes that when committed are crimes against all humanity, we can't just leave that as hollow rhetoric. It has to be that there also has to be action, and that action has to be sending in troops to stop the killing.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Polly Stryker.
Thanks, Polly, for that interesting report. We see that there is a sense of international justice, and it starts probably like most concepts of justice within smaller communities in dealing with the most outrageous criminals and malefactors, and probably extends from there. We're talking about justice across boundaries. I'm John Perry. With me is Ken Taylor.
And we're joined today by an old friend of Martha's, by an old friend of Philosophy Talk. Actually, our guest holds the record so far for appearances on Philosophy Talk. That's Martha Nussbaum. This is her third appearance. She's a professor of law and ethics at the University of Chicago. She's author of many, many books, including her latest, Frontiers of Justice, Disability, Nationality, Species Membership. Martha, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Oh, thanks so much, Ken and John. It's really great to be back on this terrific program.
Hi, Martha. Good to have you back. I've got a question for you. We've heard about these international war crimes. If we can't ignore war crimes, surely we also can't ignore, that is, we, the international community, can't ignore famine, lack of educational opportunity, unjust political systems, and lots of other ills and injustices around the world. But where does the responsibility to our fellow earthlings end, and where does paternalistic interference and bullying begin? Just take a minute and clear that up for us.
Yeah, I think that's a terrifically hard problem, actually. I think the first thing to say is that there are these staggering inequalities. A child born in many parts of sub-Saharan Africa will have a life expectancy at birth of 35 years. A child born today in the United States has life expectancy at birth of 80 years. So there's something wrong when that happens, and the children obviously are not to blame. Moreover, it's not, I mean, Ken was saying this to be devil's advocate, but I think you and he both know that it's not the case that we live in different economic systems. We live in an interlocking economic order, and the decisions that U.S. Decision makers at the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund take affect lives all around the world, and you and I do. Whenever we buy a Pepsi, whenever we make any simple consumer choice, we're affecting lives all on the other side of the world. And so even if we don't even look back to the history of how colonialism ripped off these countries, if we just look at the present, then we still are in an interlocking world.
That's certainly true. I don't want to deny that we're in an interlocking world. But I want to explore a little more deeply. It's very sad, let's say that, let's grant that, that children in other countries have lower life expectancies. It's unfortunate. It's a terrible world. But I wonder, is it a matter of injustice that they do? I mean, injustice implies that somebody did something to make that happen that they ought not to have done. It's not just that, you know, nature deals us all kind of cards, and one of the cards nature deals me is what political system I'm born into, and that can have massive consequences for my life. But why is it a matter of injustice that some people live longer and some people live shorter?
It took a long time to see the inside of a nation as an issue of justice. People used to say, well, the poor are just the poor. They've always been poor and so on. Now, I think the reason that we should see this as an issue of justice is that we are all participants in an economic order which is skewed, which creates rules that are unfair to these countries. And as I say, their natural resources have already been ripped off through a history of colonial exploitation. But now today, they have to suffer a double disadvantage by being part of an order where the G8, that is the richest eight countries, set the rules, and the International Monetary Fund has conditions on loans and so on. And no matter what they do as democratic citizens, they can't remake those transnational rules.
Well, you might want to make a distinction. I mean, let's go back in time and consider communities in remote places that were pretty much unaffected by Europe and China and the other big places. Maybe there still are some such communities in South
Tiny,
America.
Tiny, small pockets.
Yeah, not many left. Mm. But you might say in such a community, it's not really a matter of justice. They should just maybe be left alone. But or you might not say that, depending. It's a more difficult case. But our world really isn't like that. I mean, given colonialism, given the last 150 years of exploitation, or last 550 years, everybody's involved in an economic system that only a few of us get to vote for the leaders of. So I think Ken's hard criterion, there is a real sense of injustice.
There's the role of multinational corporations, too. In every country, they're competing to attract foreign investment. They want Pepsi to come there. They want Nike to come there because that helps them. But then they adjust the environmental rules to make it easy for Nike and Pepsi to come there. They adjust labor standards. You know, if Nike says, we want children in our factories, they're going to have that. So the citizens of the country no longer have the power that they used to have because the government is making decisions to get these corporations to come in.
Okay, I understand the argument that these are considerations of justice and not just of, as it were, fortune, right? I mean, not just sad or good or bad fortune, but there's a kind of element of justice there. But still, I wonder about something. It sounds like the way you, listening to you, one might think, well, what we really need to do is kind of undo all the effects of history, right? Because there were these colonial powers, they developed these massive economies, global corporations, and to have a just world order, one might hear you as saying, we need to start from scratch, like from a kind of like a new original position and say, how would we live and choose to live if we were going to have a global moral community, a global economic system, and get rid of the accidents of history? And that sounds pretty revisionary and radical.
Yeah, I mean, it's sometimes helpful to think that way to get a bearing on the problem, but I actually don't think that that makes any sense at all because, for one thing, it would be terribly undemocratic because a lot of the nations of the world now are running their own destiny to some extent. So I think what we should be doing is helping them to be more autonomous. Right now, as I say, their power to control their own destiny is very much diminished by the power of multinational corporations. So we should be helping them to be able to set the standards they want. If they don't want child labor, they should be able to do that and not be bullied into it by corporations that want to come in there and exploit children. So I think the future should be one that has nations in it, and then in which the richer nations help the poorer nations in ways that respect them, in ways that preserve their autonomy, and especially the ones that are really accountable to their people, and in ways that try to help them do the things that they actually want to do.
Well, we're going to go to break pretty soon, but we need to think now about where the rubber hits the road and how we actually assess these inequalities. What does it mean for one country to be better off or unfairly better off than another country? We'll ask you to give us some approaches to that in a minute.
Yeah, and you're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our subject today is justice across boundaries. Our guest is Martha Nussbaum from the University of Chicago Law School.
We've been talking about justice across boundaries and the idea that it makes sense to worry about it and there is injustice across boundaries. We're going to pick up on the idea of, well, exactly what does that mean and how do you measure it and how do you think about it? If you've had experience in these matters, we'd like you to join us by calling 415-841-4134.
It's 415-841-4134. Outside the Bay Area, call toll-free at 1-800-525-9917. We'll take your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
nasty. Peter Tosh, Equal Rights and Justice, a factoid. Peter was a founding member of the Wailers. Bet you didn't know that. This isn't music appreciation, though. This is Philosophy Talk, and I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Our topic today, justice across boundaries. Tell us your thoughts. We know that many of you out there have had direct experience coping with injustice across boundaries as residents of various countries, as volunteers with international aid organizations in all kinds of ways. Tell us your experiences and thoughts from the trenches fighting injustice across boundaries.
The number is 415-841-4134. I'll repeat, 415-841-4134. Don't worry if you live outside the boundaries of the Bay Area. We've got a just solution for you. You can call toll-free at 1-800-525-9917. And from anywhere in the world, you can email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
Our guest is Martha Nussbaum from the University of Chicago Law School. Martha, look, I know you've developed something called the capabilities approach. Help me understand what kinds of things we should be addressing. Maybe we should just give the poor a lot of money. Maybe we should go in and remake countries. I don't know. What kinds of things should we be trying to do? And why those things rather than some other things?
Yeah, okay. In the old days, that is, they did just think that more money is always better. And so when countries were compared as to how things are doing there, they would just look at the gross national product per capita, and they wouldn't even ask who had the money. And, of course, they didn't pay attention to whether poor people controlled any of that money or not. So you'd give very high marks to South Africa under apartheid saying, oh, there's a lot of money there someplace. And they wouldn't even ask about the racial inequalities. So what Amartya Sen, the economist who won the Nobel Prize in 1998. He and I have worked out this approach, which is known as the capabilities approach, also sometimes the human development approach, which asks, it says the question to ask is, what is each and every person actually able to do and to be? What are their basic opportunities? What can they actually do? And we ask this not just about the rich, but about each person. So then I've gone a bit further and I've come up with a definite list saying if you want to lay claim to being in a decent condition and a decently just society, you have to come up above a certain threshold on 10 fundamental human capabilities involving decent lifespan, health, bodily integrity, access to free speech and other ways of using your imagination and your senses, practical reason, the development of emotions, opportunities for various kinds of affiliations in both friendship and politics, ability to enjoy nature and relations with other species, ability to play and have leisure time, and finally some degree of control over your material and social environment. So
those are a lot of stuff. Those are
a lot of stuff. Yeah,
that's a lot of capabilities. Help me understand. You think that each person has a right somehow to exercise those capabilities or something like that?
I do. I think that a hallmark of minimal justice would be to deliver all those 10 at some reasonable threshold level. I'm influenced a lot by what constitution making is doing around the world, and the South African constitution, the Indian constitution, have given me a lot of thoughts that I use in making this list because they do guarantee those rights. And the core idea typically is the idea of a life that's commensurate with human dignity, a life that's not subhuman but is a fully human life, and then it gets spelled out in these various ways, and that's what I'm trying to do.
And you think you can do that or have done that in a way that's not kind of essentially imposing European-American values on the rest of the world?
Well, I think every society is in a state of struggle. I don't think there is a single thing of European-American values, but there sure isn't. In the country that I work in most, that is India, men and women differ, rural and urban people differ, people of different religions differ. So I think the whole idea that any culture has a single set of values is mistaken. But I think, we all need to come together and have a critical debate. And I'm just making a set of recommendations that I think I have some good arguments for. And then I want to hear what other people say. Well, and I travel around a lot. And
I tell you, though, the way you approach this sounds to me, I don't mean this to be a criticism. I just mean this to be an observation. It sounds to me kind of, in a way, kind of retrograde back to the 12th century or something. That is to say that we could specify just by looking at what human beings are, what the basic functionings are, such that only those functionings start to count as human flourishing. And there's no political contest about which of these things I mean, can we settle once and for all? You know, just by looking at human beings and what they are?
By reflecting and unpacking the concept of human dignity, which is, after all, what the Universal Declaration of Human Rights did. I mean, these people did, like I do, sit in a room and they talked among each other, and they were from China and from Egypt and from France and so on, and they tried to work out what is it to respect human dignity and what are the different parts of that. And so I see myself as basically following that example, but with a lot more attention to economic and social justice, because I think no point in protecting freedom of speech unless you're also thinking about education, about health care, and all the things that are needed to make that a workable whole in a life. But, you know, no one is going to have to do that unless their country implements it. It's a set of recommendations, rather like the Universal Declaration, which is out there, and you can use it to judge and criticize, but it's not binding on any country. And so my thought is that different countries will pick this up, and then they'll put it into their constitutional process. So then, of course, they add new things and they'll specify it in their own way. But it's a set of recommendations, and it's based quite a lot on what the international women's movement has been saying for some time, because my work has been in the international women's movement, really, first and foremost.
Well, we might raise to an issue of philosophical methodology here. And as I hear Martha's methodology, I like it. That is, there's lots of a priori conceptions of what the world is like from which people have derived conceptions of human flourishing or the Enlightenment list of values. And the problem is that the list they come up with are usually more plausible than the bases on which they put them. I mean, the Declaration of Independence, the most implausible parts are the beginning where they appeal to God. The most plausible parts are the list of things that we should have rights to. So as I understand, Martha, she's saying, look, yeah, here's my Enlightenment-derived, nature-derived, feminism-derived list. And I think lots of people are going to like it and respond to it. And if somebody's got something better, let them come along. Maybe we'll incorporate that, too. It's a kind of empirical philosophy.
Right. 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Give us a call. Tell us what you think about the capabilities approach to justice or anything you want, especially if you've been on the front lines dealing with this. So I didn't mean that as a criticism, but it did seem to me like you thought that we're somehow something about human nature that required these capacities, these capabilities, right, to be essential to human flourishing, right? Is that right or not?
I think, like John Rawls, that you don't want to have a deep kind of metaphysical theory of human nature here. You just want to say human dignity is a concept that we all employ. We do judge our countries by how well they respect human dignity. And so we have a kind of political idea of what that comes to. And let's just see what it requires in different areas of human life. It does seem to me that it definitely requires that the bodily integrity of women should be protected, both through good laws against rape, but also by making sure that the family is not off limits to justice.
What about cultural formations that seem, by our lights, to violate the bodily integrity of women, and that people in those cultural formations seem to endorse, at least superficially? I mean, you can think of something horrible like female clitorectomy, but there are all kinds of, by our lights, oppressive cultural formations. You know, religious formations, inequality between the sexes, arranged marriages, all this stuff. Right.
Well, people seem to accept that. Whose culture is it, is what we want to say. I mean, women are resisting these things all over the world. The international women's movement in international documents has taken a very strong stand against most of the things you mentioned. Not arranged marriage. I think arranged marriage where there's consent and so on, that seems to me perfectly just as good as dating as far as I can see.
I guess.
But, you know, I mean, the rate of failure is about the same. But, you know, I think also each country ought to think about how we can concretely specify each of these things in ways that make sense for us. Like the U.S. right of freedom of speech is very broad. It defends anti-Semitic speech, all kinds of hate speech that would be illegal in most other countries in the world. In Germany, there is no legality to an anti-Semitic political party. You can't even publish or disseminate anti-Semitic political materials. And, you know, I think both make sense. Ours makes sense for us, given our history, and theirs makes sense for them, given their very unfortunate history. And so I think countries do have a little bit of latitude here. Now, then how far does it extend? I think that's the real issue. And I guess I think, on, you know, where it gets to gross bodily harm to women, then I think one should draw the line.
We got a couple of email questions I'll throw at you. They're not exactly on the same topic. You can take your choice. Roger Borgen from San Francisco, isn't the topic one that lies across both the domains of justice, which implies legislated rights and correlative duties, and ethics, which involves a very different set of imperatives? And another email from South France, Mark in South San Francisco, aren't treaties supposed to address the issues of justice between nations? And that leads in a direction I'd like to press you a little, Martha. I mean, how are we going to bring this about? Treaties, bullying, invasion? What's the mechanism that you envisage for progress in this area?
Yeah, because in a nation, obviously, you, as the first writer says, you've got a bunch of laws, you've got the whole structure of the nation. But if we don't think a world state is a good idea, and I certainly don't, I think no unit that large could fail to be corrupt and unaccountable, then, you know, we've got to have a variety of different agreements that still have some teeth. We already do have a lot of them. The World Court, as your little clip showed, is already bringing people to justice across borders. The International Labor Organization has made a lot of progress in getting binding labor agreements, not only now the usual sort that involve union rights, but even in the what's called the informal sector of the economy. That is to say, you know, the things that where people do handicrafts in their home, or their hawkers and vendors, or their agricultural laborers. 90% of the women in India, and I'm sure this is true in a lot of the world, are in the informal sector, and they were not protected by any accord. Well, now they are. I mean, so we gradually have standards, and countries are going to be penalized for not living up to those standards. Environment's another one, obviously, where we need.
Martin, I'm going to press you a little bit, though. I still want to press you a little bit. Suppose that there were fair labor practices all around the world. Suppose that there were environmental regulations that everybody had to respect all around the world. Suppose that there were sane political systems all around the world. Still, wouldn't there still be a lot of inequality? Because wouldn't some people labor more effectively, more productively? And if you take the spread over the globe, some people are going to work for low wages in societies that are less productive, and some people work for high wages in societies that are more productive. Now, within a body politic, you try to even out those inequalities. Would there be any sort of reason on a global scale to, you know, apply something like Rawls's difference principles that kind of evens out inequalities that might otherwise arise?
Well, I think there are two reasons. One is historical, that is, we caused this current plight of most of these nations by the colonial process. And the second is just the economic order itself. That is, we're part of this system in which multinationals are ripping off these countries and are delivering wealth maybe to a few people in cities, but not to the rural poor, and making it harder for countries to do their own thing, because now the leaders of those countries have less power than they used to have. So I think then we have a responsibility to correct that. And that means, I think, using foreign aid intelligently and giving it a lot more. I mean, some nations of the world now give 1% of their gross national product in foreign aid, but we don't. We give about a tenth of 1%. So I think if all nations in the world gave 2%, well, just think what we could do.
Look, Martha, let me be the devil's advocate here. You sound like a real bleeding heart liberal, right? Wouldn't we just be better off making our own country as good as we can and letting others look at it as an example and see if they can muster up the energy to do the same? Most of our foreign adventures have made life worse for people instead of better, haven't they? I mean, you could say, well, World War II was a good thing. It's good we got involved in that. But, you know, if we hadn't gotten involved in World War I, we might not have had to. So, I mean, aren't you just kind of really a sob sister here?
Yes, I probably am. But I don't like the kind of foreign adventure that the U.S. has embarked on in Iraq and all sorts of other things that we've done. But I do think foreign aid, when it's given, and your news thing had this very interesting report in it, which said that the OECD has said that aid given directly to governments is more effective. And that's really what I've been urging anyway. And I think most of the time, at least when there's a decently accountable government, that's how the aid should be given. Let them then have more in to pursue their own projects, to help their own people. And then if they don't do it, then they're going to be turned out at the polls and the new government will come in. So I think the reason we should help them do that is that we actually do have a surplus. We are leading a lifestyle that is full of luxury. There's plenty of room to strip away the fat and then use that better.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Give us a call. Join our conversation. 415-841-4134. We're talking with Martha Nussbaum from the University of Chicago about justice across boundaries. Martha has an expansive conception of international justice and, I think, of our obligations. Do you share that expansive conception? Do you think we'd be entitled to, you know, look more inward? Martha, I want to press you on just that question just a little bit more. You said we've got lots of luxuries. Somebody might think, okay, look, we made this nation. We formed this nation. We formed this nation as an instrument for our mutual benefit. And when it benefits us, and the, you know, as long as we're not screwing up the rest of the world, okay, we should stop screwing up the rest of the world. But we shouldn't be sad that this instrument we formed works so well and benefits us so much, we who are a party to its formation and continuation. Should we?
Well, first of all, we didn't just make it on our own. I mean, where did the natural resources actually come from? Where does our uranium come from? Where does our gold, diamonds come from, and all that stuff? So that's the first thing I would say. But then I think that our bad thinking about luxury actually hurts our treatment of our own citizens too. I mean, why was it that in the Katrina disaster, people ended up being in such a terrible state? It's because we hadn't thought well about inequalities in our own country. And I think if we criticize luxuries, such as the luxury of having an SUV, the luxury of driving all over the place whenever you feel like it, then that will help us think better about our own country at the same time as it gives us more money to give to other people.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing justice across boundaries with Martha Nussbaum from the University of Chicago.
We've talked about approaches to conceptualizing inequality and injustice across boundaries and looked at a number of examples. But exactly what should we do about it? We'll move to that topic after the break.
Justice and intervention, plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
Games without frontiers. Peter Gabriel and Games Without Frontiers. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're discussing justice across boundaries with Martha Nussbaum from the University of Chicago. We know that there are injustices across boundaries, but what action should we do? What should we do about them? What do you think? We'd like your input.
415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Outside the Bay Area, you can call us toll-free at 1-800-525-9917, or finally, you can email us, comments@philosophytalk.org.
Barry in Oakland's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Barry.
First, let me tell you how happy I am to discover you on the air, and how happy I am to be participating in this discussion. And let me say that I'm calling as a seeker rather than as a confident critic of what has been said already. This is a very difficult topic, and I appreciate your efforts to sort some of the issues out.
Well, thank you, Barry.
A couple of things are conflated in my own hearing of what's coming about, and that is, I think I heard it, but I don't think it was pursued in the way which resolved it for me. And that is, injustice across boundaries, which presumes that we know what justice within boundaries is, and I don't know if we've discussed whether or not there is the difficulty of justice as one would have it created for another group, some abstract group or society or people, as opposed to the justice that you would accept in your own society when you are an interested party.
I'm not quite sure I get your distinction. I mean,
the distinction is between a child's notion of justice and one who is an operator, a principal in a society, like corporations. I once tried to teach ethics in the business community. And the difference between people who have ethical ideas and notions of justice and those who are prepared to take a cut in their annual income or paycheck or receive bonuses is another matter. They change from being a naive or being a sincere seeker of justice to one who becomes a litigator, and how much can I keep for myself?
Okay, Barry, thanks. Martha, do you have any thoughts about Barry's question?
Well, I guess I think, you know, corporations, a lot of the leaders of them really want to do something about these problems, but they're caught in this competition where it's very hard for an individual to take an ethical stance. So that's why we need international laws and accords. It's like before the New Deal, during the Depression, we probably did have some ethical leaders in business, but because they were competing with unethical people, you know, they had to play by that those non-rules. And so then the New Deal put in some tough rules. And I think that's what we want, a New Deal for the world. That's basically what I'm saying.
So, Martha, we've got some email here that has to do with Google and China. Google says that it's going to accept the fact that their local China-based Google information service, Google.cn or whatever it is, will not allow them to give full search results to certain questions. And they say they think the Chinese will be better and off for that than if they don't do anything. What does your approach say about that kind of difficult decision?
Well, yeah, that is a very difficult kind of decision, because I think probably their being there opens up more channels of information seeking and communication than would otherwise be there without them. You know, in the end, I think it would be good if the people who are part of that company as individuals and as citizens should also at the same time be criticizing the denial of human rights in China. And, you know, even if the company feels that that's unbalanced, the best decision that they can make right now, it's a kind of tragic choice. And when you have that kind of tragic choice where you're doing something that violates some other ethical rule, then I think what you have to do is try to figure out how you can make the world better in the future so that people don't have that tragic choice. That just means working for human rights all over the world.
Matt in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Matt.
Hey, thanks very much. I was mentioning to your producer that I hadn't heard the whole discussion, but one of the things that I regard as important in any consideration of international laws and ethics as regards the United States and its policies abroad, is to keep in mind that many things that our government does, especially at the behest of corporations, for example, in the military-industrial complex, are things which aren't typically used in formulating international policy. You know, the effects of the arms trade abroad, for example,
yeah,
that kind of thing, are things which are kind of difficult to quantify as far as their kind of, you know, the ways that they backfire on U.S. policy down the line. And I think that kind of thing is often neglected in this kind of discussion.
I think you're right, Matt. But Martha, I want to broaden this question. Thanks a lot, man. I want to broaden this question just a little bit. Look, I want you to give me a middle ground between two disastrous things. Intervention in Iraq, which George Bush probably thinks of as some kind of humanitarian intervention. And let's face it, Iraq was a theater of injustice, deep injustice under Saddam Hussein. And our non-intervention in Darfur or Rwanda. I mean, both the non-intervention is a tragedy on the one hand, the intervention is a tragedy on the other. How do we steer a middle ground, a wise middle ground?
Yeah, I guess I think the whole question of humanitarian intervention is very, very difficult. And you really have to, I mean, there's first of all ethical considerations, like it's only permitted, I think, to interfere with the affairs of a sovereign nation that's decently accountable in a very, very small number of cases involving genocide and the biggest kinds of crimes against humanity. When you have a non-accountable tyranny or a failed state, then I think the threshold for intervention goes down. But then the practical problems start coming in. I mean, how much does it cost? What good are we actually going to do? And my partner, Cass Sunstein, has an op-ed in the Washington Post coming out in the next couple of days that says the whole cost of obeying all the things that the Kyoto Protocol wanted us to do for the environment is exactly the same amount of money that's been spent on the Iraq War up until today. So, you know, you look at that and you think this is a terrible, I mean, even if it had been the best case of humanitarian intervention, it was a terrible way, because nothing was accomplished, and things are worse there than before, and we've meanwhile spent all this money that we could have been spending on other things.
So I'm looking for a principle that helps me steer a middle ground between inaction where action is called for and wise action, mm-hmm, where action is called for instead of rash. I'm trying to find a middle ground.
Well, I don't think there's a very clear principle, you know. I mean, this is one place where we just have to look hard at the case and think about the total costs. And I do think that Rwanda was a terrible case of non-intervention, because it was pretty well known that if we had intervened, we could have done a lot of good very quickly and without prohibitive costs. And that everyone agreed on that. And I think Darfur is a similar case. Iraq was always a much more difficult case because you had a military that were loyal to the regime. And so even if you thought that this was a terrific case for humanitarian intervention, which I didn't, and I don't think our leaders really did either. I think that was just a pretext for other interests. But anyway, then you knew right away that the cost would be much greater. And I think one could have predicted, I mean, I certainly did predict that it would degenerate into decay and it would become a kind of terrorist haven,
Martha,
and so on.
On that note of non-principle, I'm going to have to thank you for joining us. It's been great, as always, having you.
Okay, great to talk to you, John and Ken.
Our guest has been Martha Nussbaum, professor of law and ethics at the University of Chicago, author of many books, including most recently Frontiers of Justice, Disability, Nationality, and Species Membership.
Oh, we want to thank all the callers we didn't get a chance to talk to and all the emailers we didn't get a chance to read your emails.
The callers mostly didn't call because of, we don't quite know why, but we know you're out there. But, John, what did we learn today?
Well, I think we learned, as always, that Martha is a very thoughtful person who's unafraid to take on big challenges like emotions, some of the topics of some of her earlier books, and justice across boundaries. We reminded, if we needed it, of how unjust the world is. I think the capabilities approach has a lot going for it. I don't think you can bring it out a priori, but I think if you take those 10 or 12 principles that she enunciated and go around the world and say, look, maybe with Confucian ethics or the insights of Buddhism or something else, you can round these out or de-emphasize some or re-emphasize others. It's still a pretty compelling conception of human, what a human being ought to have minimally in the 21st century.
I would tend to agree with you. I mean, the capabilities that she enunciates sound like things that are fundamental and basic to me, but I do kind of fear that there's a kind of cultural hegemony of Western liberal elites behind the scenes.
Yeah, but if you're going to have a cultural hegemony, Western liberal elites and sob sisters and wishy-washy liberals like myself, it's not bad. Not bad hegemony to have.
That's true. It's better than sort of rapacious capitalism. Yeah. And there's two sort of globalizing forces, Western liberal elites and globalizing capitalism. And if those are the two you have to choose between, well, you might think, I'll take the liberal elites with their do-good impulses. But this conversation continues, as always, on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blogo, I think, therefore I blog.
Yes, and I haven't been thinking lately, so I haven't been blogging lately, but I'll get back to it when this tough quarter is over. You can also download podcasts of our program from our website.
And another way to get involved and to get in contact with us is to submit a conundrum, a situation you face in your personal or professional life that bedevils your mind. If you want some philosophical insight, give us a conundrum, and we have one right now.
It's time to take a call from one of our listeners.
Oh, and why don't we do that? Joel's on the line now. Hi, Joel. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Yes, I am on the line. Thank you for having me.
Where are you calling from, Joel?
Portland, Oregon.
One of our favorite places.
What do you do up there in Portland, Joel?
I work in the IT field, basically computer networks, things like that.
So tell us about your conundrum.
Well, it's a historical one from the American Revolution. Basically, in early 1778, the Continental Congress authorized General George Washington to negotiate with his counterpart, General Howe, the British commander, for a POW exchange. Privately, members of Congress told Washington to negotiate in bad faith, in other words, appear to negotiate for the exchange, but to actually try and avoid an exchange. And the reason for that being that it was much easier for our army to replace captured soldiers than it was for the British, who obviously had to import them over from England.
That's pretty clever thinking on the part of those congressmen.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
I think the standards for that office have gone downhill since then. On the other hand, the tradition of two-facedness and duplicitness kind of has carried on for all these centuries. But let's get to the point,
yeah,
Ken.
What do you think? What puzzles you about this? What conundrums your drum about this?
Well, basically, Washington rejected that advice and told his handful of commissioners who are going to do the actual negotiating to negotiate in good faith. So, I mean, the conundrum is sort of what the Congress had privately advised made sense in the sense of winning the war, On the other hand, it's kind of immoral, especially since during the war there were 4,500 battle casualties, but 11,000 American soldiers died as POWs, so it was pretty bad to get captured.
So the British were not taking good care of the POWs.
Yeah, they kept most of the POWs on derelict ships that were anchored off like the coast of New York and stuff, so it was very easy for diseases and things like that to just go through these overcrowded prison ships.
You had the intuition that it would have been immoral for Washington to do what the Continental Congress said, and I guess Washington must have had the same intuition because he didn't do what they said. But I'm wondering, where does that come from?
Well, let's think about it from a theoretical point of view. Now, suppose you take a kind of utilitarian point of view, not a pure utilitarian point of view, because I suppose a pure utilitarian has to take into account the pain and pleasure and the good and bad of everybody in the whole world, but just kind of a self-interested, that is, our side interested utilitarian calculation. Are more boys going to die, more soldiers going to die as a result of the British being able to refresh their troops with their recovered POWs than will die by rotting on those ships off the coast? Now, if a congressman was a hard-nosed consequentialist and said, well, greatest good for the greatest number, at least the greatest number of patriots that are involved in this, that's a possible moral perspective. Yeah, it's very hard on those guys on the ships, but if we get them back and let the British have their guys back, in the end, it's going to cost more lives of our boys than if we don't. That'd be moral from that point of view, wouldn't it?
Well, given that almost three times as many Americans died as POWs and died on the battlefield, it would seem like the last thing you want to have happen to you, I mean, other than getting killed on the battlefield, is to be taken POW.
So it looks like the congressman's point of view is more, we have this unending supply of soldiers, and they're pretty expendable, and they don't have an unending supply of soldiers, so we need to take advantage of our resources. It's just like saying, you know, we've got more firewood than they've got, so let's wait till the winter when they have to heat everything.
It's regarding one's own soldiers as mere instruments. That's the thing that Washington objected to.
So I'm on your side and Washington's side, and where was Alexander Hamilton on all of this?
He was an aide-de-camp to General Washington. He was a lieutenant colonel. He was one of the handful of negotiators that Washington made, and he was strongly opposed to doing what Congress wanted. In other words, he and the other commissioners actually told Washington they would not serve on the commission if they were ordered to negotiate.
See, now I'm beginning to understand this a little better. You're giving us a more historical context of why, when they came to write the Constitution, they said the president is the commander-in-chief. Because obviously these guys deeply resented the Continental Congress's interference.
Well, Joel, I don't think we've taught you anything about morality, because I think your intuitions and Washington's intuitions were correct. But you've taught us something about American history, and we thank you very much for that.
Thank you for having me.
If you have a philosophical problem or quandary that's affecting your work or your play or keeping you awake at night, John and I would be happy to lend an ear and maybe give you some sound advice.
Go to the Philosophy Talk website and poke the conundrums button with your mouse, or just send an email to conundrums@philosophytalk.org. Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
We owe special thanks to Devin Strolovich, Neil Van Leeuwen, Ben Timpson, and Alan Farley. Our senior consulting producer is Gordon Earle.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University, including the Stanford Humanities Center, the Office of the Dean of Research, the Dean of Humanities and Sciences, and the Provost and President.
Also from the Friends of Philosophy Talk, the members of KALW, Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our funders.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.